I want to welcome everybody and thank you for coming to our Women We Admire speaker series. I'm Margaret Wu. I'm one of the co-vice chairs of PACSAW, the President's Advisory Committee for the Status of Women. As you may know, this is a speaker series that we've been sponsoring since 2009, trying to bring women from throughout the UC system to come talk about their careers and share some insights with us here at OP. Before I introduce our introducer, just wanted to have a couple of administrative things. First of all, those of you who are on the phone, if you could please mute, that would be great. We are recording this session. Just so you know, our next scheduled speaker is none other than President Janet Napolitano on July 22nd. She will be speaking at the Elihu Harris State Building, so we can accommodate everybody who wants to be there. It will be at noon, but as always, please make sure you get there a little bit early because they have security check-in procedures. And without further ado, I will introduce, it's my pleasure to introduce another woman we admire who has spoken to us before, Provost Amy Doar, who will tell you about our speaker today. Thank you.
So it is my pleasure and an honor to introduce today's woman we admire every day, Susan Carlson. She came to UCOP in 2010 to serve as the Vice Provost for Academic Personnel. In 2012, when the Vice Provost for Academic Planning Programs and Coordination left for the Gates Foundation, Susan took over an interim appointment there and handled many, not quite all the parts, because ATTC was getting broken up, but many of the parts of ATTC. So in the nearly 2 years that I've been the provost, which is where I got to know Susan, I have greatly admired her leadership and her commitment and her performance. But I have to tell you that the admiration started before I became the provost. What I can't remember is whether it was before I even interviewed or before I interviewed with the president, one or the other, because somewhere during that time I decided that I needed to talk to Larry Pitts, the current provost, and all the direct reports. So I was at some conference. I spent my whole day in a hotel room talking to people on the phone for a couple of days, and one of them, of course, was Susan. And she was the one who was simultaneously the most informative, the most positive, the most encouraging of all the people I talked with. She had enthusiasm for her job, which is still here, and she'd already been in it 2 years, and she had this great sense of how wonderful UC was, how much it was worth working for, and simultaneously how much better it could be. And that's what I've seen all the time, and it's quite fantastic. So she is right now officially the Vice Provost for Academic Personnel. And there, you know, they do policy, they do practice, they do a variety of diversity and climate activities, some grant sponsors, some her own interests. The Academic Personnel Manual, which is really absolutely amazing document, as is the entire process for creating academic personnel policy and changing it, resides with her. She has outstanding staff to work on it, but it resides with her. I'm not going to call out all your staff who are also outstanding. She also works on, policy, also on a labor contract for academic appointees, and develops analyses like when campuses want to go over policy in terms of what they can study. A faculty member usually, her office does all the analysis of, is this okay, not okay, why is it okay, and then it comes to me, I have to approve it. And occasionally Susan and I go, or worry over it quite a bit, and then she goes back and talks to the campus. And later today, we're going to have another one of those conversations. So, and then as interim vice provost, Susan has assumed responsibility throughout this two-year period for a lot of system-wide programs and activities. There's undergraduate education programs that are system-wide, like the UC in Washington, D.C. program, the UC Education Abroad program. The director of the program is here in the back, and the UC Sacramento Center. They also are, she's also becoming engaged with the Natural Reserve System course as well. There also are various sort of publication-oriented or media academic resource organizations that report to her. One is UC Press. Another is California Digital Library. The director of CDL is here. That CDL happens to be one of the things that the campuses and the faculty always talk about as a very precious resource, and they're always saying you better take care of it. So there also is UC TV that's in San Diego that reports to her, and something that used to be called, it's now Scout, the online academy. What was it called?
UC College Prep Online.
There you go, UC College Prep Online. It's still College Prep. It started in the 90s, online, aimed for students in schools where they didn't offer honors, AP, and advanced courses in California. And they still do that. They do that part for those kinds of students and schools free of charge, but now they also charge to other people. And they have a very active program. And let's see what else is there. I forgot. Oh, yeah. Well, one other one that is very active right now is officially called La Casa de la Universidad de California, otherwise Casa de California. And it's been a it was purchased before Susan came with many great intentions from the governor and the legislature and UC, and it worked beautifully for a while, and then it fell apart, and now the question is, do we have a white elephant? Do we put it on sale? Do we trade it in at Christmas? Or do we make a great thing out of it again, and how are we going to do it? And that resides largely with Susan as well. So within UC, Susan's a very effective and a very well-liked vice provost. I know that from when I came and what people said and who they referred me to. She's also a very active representative of UC to the rest of the world. She serves on board. She is on the Women's Network of the American Council on Education. She has an NSF grant that's called UC Advance, which is diversifying STEM fields, and she serves on board for other advanced grants. She also participated in, I got one more that I thought was interesting, where is it? The Delphi Project, where is that? The Delphi Project on the changing faculty and student success. And do you know what a Delphi Project is? If you don't, you can ask. It's pretty interesting strategy for what to do. So Susan started out with a bachelor's from the University of Iowa and a MA and a PhD from the University of Oregon. She was a faculty member for 30 years at Iowa State as a professor of English. She wrote books. Her areas are women, comedy, Shakespeare, women playwrights, and the British suffrage theater, okay. So you get her areas of expertise, and they're really fun to talk about and think about. And she also, she was meant for UC Education Abroad because she collaborated with Michael Mendelson, who also happens to be her husband, in teaching a study abroad course in London. So you were fated from an early time to have the job that you have now. Her professional life, she also has a faculty appointment at Davis in English, but her professional life is here, very much here, here in body and spirit, working with the campuses also, and here in representing us out to the world, for which she does a fantastic job. And I'm really looking forward to what of all of us she's going to talk about. So.
Like a good English professor, I've written my remarks.
those of you, I just learned John was an English graduate. But if you know the discipline of English, when you go to conferences as an English professor, you also always read what you want to say. So I think it's a way of preserving your time in doing this in a way I think will be both informative and I hope entertaining. But I want to start by saying thank you to the PACSOF folks. This is really a fabulous group, and in my time here, I've really seen how it's made a difference in climate and community, and those are both things that are quite important to me. So thanks for having me. I'm very excited to be here and to speak to you all. And in addition to Amy, who's a wonderful colleague, I have many other wonderful colleagues here today, so I'm a little nervous. And I don't like talking about myself, so that makes this especially tough and difficult, but I will do it for you because you're all my colleagues. Let me start by saying because I don't like to talk about myself, I'm considering this, I'm kind of giving you a case study, and it's a case study which will give you some ways to think about women in the workplace, which is going to be really the primary focus, and someone, me, who's seen, you'll hear since I was pretty little, who's seen the effect of gender in the world. So that's going to be clearly the recurring theme here, which I would probably do anytime I was asked to talk about myself, but obviously it's particularly apt for a session sponsored by the committee, the President's Committee on Women. So I'll touch on a few formative moments, which means when I was really little. But I wanted to start by listing, I don't think this is an exhaustive list, but these are, I think, the most important principles and priorities of my life. And it ends up being not just my work life, but all my life, because it's very hard for me to disentangle the two. So really the first, and it's really not a principle, it's just sort of the way it is, which is the importance to me of work and the personal and the family all being integrated. I never once in my life thought about not working. It was really for me always how to make it work. And, you know, I'm grateful that I was able to make it work. So my life is really, I would call, fully blended. So when I'm here at work, my family's always with me, my personal life's always with me, and when I'm home, my work life's always with me. But I really don't mind. You know, I consider that a choice, and to have a wonderful job, you know, that sort of comes with the territory. So let me start by listing a few things that I do consider more principles that guide me. And the first one is building community and building networks. So that's why this to me is a particularly important exercise for me to kind of, I think, demonstrate to you my commitment to you and how important you are. And to me, the communities that I'm part of should be fair communities and inclusive communities, and that's something I've noticed my whole life and spent a lot of my life working on. Second, to me, it's been important in my working life to make a difference, and I'm truly grateful that I've had jobs. Once I had degrees, every job I had allowed me to do that. You know, first as a faculty member, when you're teaching, it's an amazing opportunity to get, you know, to be able to reach students in ways you can't always predict. I could do that in research, but I'll talk a little more about that later. And certainly as an administrator, one of the reasons I became an administrator was because it seemed to me a clear way for me, given my skills and interests, to make a difference then through my work as a faculty member. Third, I like to remember keep in mind what I call scale and perspective. So perspective meaning I'm always thinking about where somebody comes from and what they bring to any conversation or project. Sometimes that's personal identity, sometimes it's politics, but it can be any number of things. You know, for me, sometimes it means I'm thinking as a woman, sometimes I'm thinking as a faculty member, sometimes I'm thinking as a mother, a wife, you know, an administrator, sometimes all of those at the same time. And they all, you know, bring you to different things. I'll say more about my husband later, but he's also a professor of English who's retired now, but the book he wrote was called Many Sides, which is a rhetorical look at argument. And he really, I'm his best student. But he has taught me the importance of many sides to every argument. So I think live that principle. So that's the perspective side. And the scale side is trying to keep my life at a manageable scale, which isn't always easy, you know, which means having both personal and work and somehow making them stay together. The example I used to use, which I don't use anymore, was being able to change the oil in my car, which I did at one point, but now I can't. You know, I don't plus, I don't know how to do it on my current car, and I probably don't have time to do it. But I was very proud of that, and that was part of, you know, how I kept scale. So I want to start with some examples. As I said, it's really always been core to my personal and my working life to be alert to what it means to be female. So I wanted to begin with one of my favorite examples, my mother's maiden name. So that's the title of this talk. So I moved to California just about 4 years ago. Moving meant that I had to rethink and redo everything in my life. So I've been in Iowa almost my whole life, you know, was 5 years off to go to Oregon to graduate school. So moving from Iowa here was a huge change. So along the way, I put my family's financial and banking records online. We opened up new accounts with banks, utilities, insurance vendors, phone and cable companies, the Department of Motor Vehicles, Fast Track, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We got new phones, new computers and email accounts, new veterinarians, and new doctors. So along the way of managing this change, and many of you have been through the same thing, I felt that I was mired in a world of passwords. Usernames, secret prompt questions, in case I forgot one of my new passwords. So as you know, the secret prompt questions are based on things you will never forget. Your favorite childhood pet, your best friend in high school, your grade school, your favorite color, and your mother's maiden name, which I consider a very loaded term. So here's the story. I had a very positive attitude to my mother's maiden name until third grade. I was a child in the 50s and the 60s, in the middle of Iowa, in the middle of the country. And the norms for a middle-class white woman, my mother, were marriage, children, homemaking, and community. Happy as I was, in really what was truly an archetypal suburban family, mother, father, two brothers, a dog, a bird, grade school and junior high in walking distance. It was junior high back then, by the way. Hot lunch, you know, when you got to the school, all of which were amazing. But in the light of all that, my mother's maiden name really got in the way. So I have several props today. No PowerPoint, but some props. So because this is about my mother, I brought my mother's Shirley Temple doll. She's a little fragile. From the 1930s. So Shirley's going to kind of stand in for my mother. I think she can do that. And my mother is a big doll collector, so my mother died a couple of years ago, and I have now all her dolls. Even though I've got two dolls for you today, but I'm not really a doll person. So. Anyway, so in third grade class, one Friday show and tell was to bring in your mother's maiden name. So I was born Susan Carlson. My mother was born Connie Carlson. Then she conveniently married a Carlson. My grandmother was also born Carlson, and she conveniently married a Carlson. So clearly there were no shortage of Swedish immigrants in Iowa. So I was proud. I was incredibly proud when my turn came to tell my fellow third graders that my mother's maiden name was Carlson, that she never even had to think about changing her name. Well, you could imagine the result. It was instant humiliation. I remember this was in the early 60s, or something like that. Mrs. Stout, my teacher, said that I obviously had misunderstood the assignment and that I could recheck with my mother on her real maiden name. I protested, of course, that I had it right, but a young girl was not allowed to challenge, albeit inadvertently, the idea that women married and gave up maiden names for married ones. So I don't think this is really a random moment in my life, and it really represents a lot to me, and clearly it stuck with me. And it clarifies assumptions for me that are so often hidden about women's roles and decisions. So when Mrs. Stout, my teacher, Wells Fargo Bank, my Visa card, and PG&E asked me for my mother's maiden name, what are they assuming? First, they're assuming that mothers are married and give up birth names. They assume that women are maiden until they get married. They assume that the maiden name that represents, I think, in the traditional sense of the word, traditional meaning of the word connotation, they're assuming that maiden name represents an independent past that is so secret and so erased that no one except a son or a daughter needing a password will have access to that secret. I think, finally, this is a kind of more of a contemporary spin on this. I think they're assuming that there's only one, obviously, one cultural way of naming at the point of marriage. And we all know that there's many, but not in the middle of Iowa in the late 1900s. I certainly never set out to be a feminist, and I have, you know, a life that would never have been predicted to lead me to this, but these events kept showing up. By the way, I'm also very happy to say that I had a great aunt who was always called a maiden aunt, who'd never been married, spent 50 years teaching first grade, and she's one of the, you know, the models of my life, so I have nothing against maiden anybody. And she probably was also a virgin, so. So now it's time for prop number two. Which is also a doll. So Barbie. So this is my Barbie doll. Actually, it was a lot of fun to dig out my Barbie doll and to find her shoes, and I could only find one glove and one of my favorite outfits. She's there. Barbie first came out in 1959. And it's quite likely that my Barbie doll is from one of the first couple of years. I loved Barbie, and I spent many hours and days with her. All of my friends had Barbies, although in those days you only had one Barbie. One. And I had a Ken doll who was never much fun, I have to admit. Clothes weren't, you know, weren't any fun. I had a Skipper doll, and Skipper, the little sister, and Midge, the best friend. I love the clothes. In fact, my mother and I used to sew clothes for my Barbie doll. So I brought you a store-bought outfit because it looked a little better. but she really Barbie represents a lot of my childhood that way. Actually, mostly in a wonderful, happy way. But she's kind of just standing in for the period and what I want to say a little bit next about my experiences as a little girl in the middle of Iowa with two brothers. I went to all of my brothers' Cub Scout and Boy Scout den meeting when I was small. They never once came to my Campfire Girl meeting. I attended, I believe, or at least it felt like it, every last one of my brothers' Little League games. My mother and I kept the score. We kept the official score, so we did hits, runs, errors, fly out, strike, you know, the whole bit. And, of course, there was no Little League for girls. In the sports area, I guess I felt I had to get even at some point in my life, so I learned to play golf, which was one of my family activities, and played until I beat my father, and I beat my boss, so then I thought it was time to quit. And I could go on with moments like this that I think really do define who I am, but there's just two that, again, you know, stick in my craw forever. One was that in Iowa, of course, it snowed a lot in the winter, and you had to go out as a child, go out shovel the snow. So my two brothers, I have one older brother and one younger brother. My two brothers, of course, could go out and shovel snow at the neighbor's house, and they could earn money for shoveling snow. But the daughter couldn't do that. So I got to, you know, and I was better than either of them. I had to stay home and shovel on my own driveway and my own sidewalk. And I also wasn't allowed to mow the lawn. Pardon? No, I did not get paid either. I did not get paid. I would say that the experience has really trained me to be alert to differences in how people are treated and valued. I didn't have to deal with many differences. Other people have to deal with differences of race, for example. I had the privilege of being white, but the gender issues really stuck with me. But in any case, I was encouraged to be a good student. Soon enough, of course, I went to college, I went to graduate school, I became a faculty member, and I really got to do what I loved, really, and I still do what I love, which I consider an amazing privilege. So I want to pull out my next prop, which is not a doll. Cup and saucer, this is really, you know, the best I could do is carry in. To stand in for the dining room, which is kind of the next theme I'd like to turn to. And I'll explain it in a bit. But I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about my academic work, which also I think stands behind the work I do now and the way I think and approach the work that we all do here at the University of California. As I said, I've always loved my work. I've always worked 7 days a week, and I've really always felt not fully satisfied unless I had more work to do than time to do it in. So that's just, you know, what has always felt right to me. I guess when it doesn't feel right anymore, it'll be time to retire. So I'll be looking for that moment. Most of the research, Amy mentioned the kind of research that I did as a scholar, and my main focus was on women and comedy. And I studied both how comedy can be used against women to restrict their behavior and for women to express their triumphs. A driving goal really was to understand how and when comedy could be used as a change agent, and also when it wasn't a change agent. I spent lots of time interviewing and working with contemporary playwrights, directors, and actors, and I was always asking them how they used the theater to change the world. I was particularly attracted to plays in which women find agency, community, joy, and laughter. So as a faculty member, I got tenured, got married, got pregnant, and conveniently in that order. I did that, as Amy said, for 30 years. I never planned to be an administrator. It didn't look like much fun. And I really loved being a faculty member. But increasingly, my fellow faculty members noticed that I dependably came to meetings. You know where this is going. I volunteered to do work, and then I completed the work. And I could be trusted to be open and honest, which was enough to set me apart from many of my... I also ended up... And so then I, you know... Got appointed to and started doing administration. Actually, at a point in my life where my children were of an age where it seemed okay to me to be doing that kind of work. Although I found that I could have done it much earlier. I don't think I could have accepted that at the time. I wanted to talk about one, again, as kind of a representative example, a committee that I served on that I thought would be particularly apt for this group, and I hope you'll find it interesting. So this is my final prop. And this is about a group called the Tampon Passport. So for those of you on the phone, I've got a poster I'm showing right now. Real-life examples of women's sanitary products. So here's the story behind the tampon test. It actually, of course, wasn't called that, but you'll see why that's an apt name for it. When I was the associate provost at Iowa State University, and I had the University Committee on Women reporting to me, one day the vice president for business came to me, and he let me know that he was concerned about the cost of supplying women's restrooms with tampons and sanitary napkins. So they were doing a comprehensive study of where the vending machines were for feminine hygiene products, how many of them worked, and how many did not, how much use they got, and they were really worried about how complicated it was to assign staff members to collect the money, because only certain staff members could be trusted with money. And, of course, you know how much money was in those machines. And, by the way, to build my prop here, I went around the building here and tried the machine. I don't need the machines anymore, which is 100% at my stage of life. It took me 4 bathrooms. So you all know that, but I didn't know that. So somewhere along the line, the vice president and his colleagues decided that it would be a good idea to consult with women. And I'm not making this up. This truly happened. And so this led to one of the most comic moments in my administrative life. So I'll spare you all the details, but give you a couple of highlights. We had quite a few meetings along the way, both the Committee on Women and then in partnership with the vice president and his colleagues. But the most unforgettable one included 3 senior male administrators, 2 of them vice presidents, and a host of us representing the Committee on Women. The men were really uncomfortable, and we did feel kind of sorry for them. And they came armed with tables and graphs and reports and cost estimates and spreadsheets with information on all the women's restrooms across campus. But the story had a very happy ending. We convinced the administrators that they could save money, reduce bureaucracy, and make women pretty happy by providing tampons and sanitary napkins free alongside toilet paper and soap. So I have to say, I think about this every time I walk in the bathroom. And I think, I haven't done this, but I think after today I will put this on the efficiency plan. It really is. I mean, there's no reason in the world to do it this way. You come up with one, and I've got an argument for it. So that's, you know, one of the most interesting examples I could come up with. But I continue to be driven by this desire to make the world a better place, even in bathrooms. And, again, that's why UC is such an amazing place to work. You all know that. So let me end by going back to the dining room and the teacup and saucer. Amy mentioned that I'm married. I have a husband, Michael Mendelson, and we have 2 sons. And we both, Michael was also, I guess I said this, an English professor at Iowa State. We both worked full-time while they were growing up. And they're now 27 and 24, by the way. Maybe this is sorry to say to some of you, but, you know, once they were out of the house, we just worked more. So, and loved it. And again, you know, we never considered not working, but we did develop, I think, really through action rather than sitting down and making a list, although we do that quite a bit in my family. But there were really, I'd say, 3 principles that drove how we manage this life. So I thought you might find this somewhat interesting. The first, because we're both academics, was for us to excel as teachers, scholars, and academics in our community. And since I was doing feminist research, it was particularly important to me to show that women could succeed. So between the birth of my 2 children, I wrote my 2nd book, partly to prove to myself that I could still do it, that was going to happen, and, you know, to show others that they could do the same kind of thing. So that was 1. 2 was to be good parents. And because we didn't mind working every night, in fact, that seemed stimulating and interesting, we would juggle schedules throughout the whole day to see our kids off to school in the morning and we lived, you know, in a small town in Iowa, so they could walk to school, and it was safe, and it was wonderful. So we would see them off to school in the morning. We could greet them at home at the end of the day. We would go to soccer games, which neither of us found particularly interesting. So we would take papers along and grade them during the But we never did it when our sons were playing. But this was, you know, Parks and Rec soccer, so everyone played their equal share of time, and our children were not stars. They played a lot. So, you know, and along the way, of course, there's ups and downs in any family, and we certainly had our share. But I found that I had to, particularly when I became an administrator, I had to compartmentalize my emotional life, sort of what happened at work and what happened at home. Because at first I realized that if I'd had a particularly stressful day, I would come home and take it out on my kids, and which is really, of course, not a good thing to do. But I learned to compartmentalize and didn't do that after a few bad days, so that every time they got yelled at, they truly deserved it. But the third, and to me, this is sort of really uniquely my family. The third principle we have is what we call talking time. And the teacup could just as well be a wine glass for talking time. So Michael and I have always insisted that at the end of a traditional workday, we have talking time. Talking time starts when you're both home, and that could be 4:30, 5:30, 6:30, 8, you know, whenever it happens. And it always involves debriefing on the triumphs and the disasters of the day. It, as I said, it's usually accompanied by a glass of wine and some kind of a snack. I have an amazing husband who now that he's retired, prepares amazing snacks at the end of every day. It's quite extraordinary. When they were little, our boys would hang around for a while at the beginning of talking time, but you know they would get exhausted pretty quickly, and they'd wander around. And they really had to wait for dinner until we were done talking. So dinner at our house was often really, really late, but it was, you know, that just kind of was what happened. And they survived. They were just fine. So it's become a time, and we still do it. It's become a time to weave together work and family, world affairs, opinion, and often friends as well. So anyone who comes to visit us has to do talking time. So, and they kind of usually, I mean, it always makes you feel better. So people mostly like it. So in some, we've had kind of spin-offs. So we have some other families that kind of, they're not as good as us. They kind of do talking. So for me, the dining room, which is where talking time often did take place and does take place, represents really the fusion of work and life, and of these three principles that I was just reading out to you. So the dining room also represents to me, when I realized what had happened, it told me a lot about how I wanted to bring the parts of my life together. So the house we lived in Iowa was a two-story house, and the study that Michael and I shared was on the second floor. But I realized the older my kids got, I kept gravitating to do my work downstairs and ended up in the dining room where there was the most space to put papers and books and computers. And I did that really so I wouldn't miss out on anything. You know, and my boys are not particularly one of them is very bad about sharing things. So you had to be there any moment where he might be ready to tell you something. The other one's pretty good, but even there it was just important to be in the environment where something, you know, something, whatever it was, might happen. So I really have find, and I'm sure this is true for some of you, the administrative work that is now my work life is seductive. The pace and the urgency sucks you in, and I find I do have to be careful not to let it take over my life. So the dining room is one of the measures I have for trying to ensure that there's a balance to keep me somewhere in a healthy zone. So I'm done. I'm grateful to have had the opportunities I've had in my career, and it's really fun to get to talk to you all about it, and now I never have to do it again. Q&A or discussion, if you have. Talking time.
Right. So I'm really curious, how did you make the decision to leave a place you've been your whole life and come here? What prompted you?
This
has been the building. And
well, I mean, the opportunity at UC, there's nothing like the job I have. The first job I had, right, the academic personnel, to have, you know, the APM is pretty unusual, but the way academic stuff happens at UC is really amazing. So I knew a lot about UC, even in the middle of Iowa, and we used several UC policies to build family-friendly policies, for example, in Iowa. My husband's from California. So Michael grew up in Burlingame, so on the peninsula, and he felt sort of exiled in Iowa, where he spent 30 years. So he, you know, he put up with it for a long time. But we were pretty sure we wouldn't end up there forever. The hardest, and we had no idea where our kids would be. Actually, when we left, when I started here, our younger son was still in school in Ames, the place we left, and my friends couldn't believe we're doing this, but I have to tell you, at that stage, I maybe saw Noah on average 2 minutes a week. You know, so it was. I actually had better communications with him when I left. That was true. So I felt kind of bad, but not really. So the hardest part for me was to leave my mom, who had lived 30 miles away from us. When I left, she was in perfect health. Her family history would have predicted she'd live for 10 or 15 more years, and she didn't. So that was the hard part about leaving. So we knew we were ready to leave, and I had I found when we moved here, I found my old journals from the more tumultuous years of my life, and realized that when I came to Oregon as a graduate student, the West was a really strong pull on me. At that point, I didn't apply to any California schools because California was too scary. It was too big a transition. I just couldn't even think about it. But the West has always been a draw. So, and you know, with Michael having friends and family here, that, you know, made it okay. And now both of our kids moved to California on their own choice, which was amazing. So one just graduated from the journalism school in Berkeley on Saturday. And the other one's at UC San Diego in chemistry. So that's pretty amazing. Yeah. It was hard. It was hard. But it was exactly the right thing to do. Okay, other comments or questions?
I'm curious about the climate survey results. And you know, you talk about diversity and you talk about kind of how you value the differences. Do you have any suggestions of how you see OP or you could take the climate survey results to really make a difference in the workplace that you talk about? Tough question, but I'd really be interested to
hear. Well, I do think it's important to talk about the results. I mean, because we also did a climate survey when I was at Iowa State, and the talking about the results really did make a difference. And almost every conversation I was in would start with, well, here's why these results, you know, aren't the right methodology, or they forgot to do this and that. But it inevitably led to a discussion of real things. So it was like a way of opening up a discussion, and someone didn't necessarily have to say, that happened to me, and admit, you know, to some little hurt or some big hurt, but could join in part of the conversation. So I do think that's important. So that's what I would do now that we've got a climate survey. And we all know there's a lot of things people think might not be right about the climate survey, but we've got it. So I really think we do have to do something with it. Those of you who spend time with me know I complain a lot about this building, and because it really isn't very well suited to building community, to having conversations. I mean, this room is great, but this is the only room like this. So, and it's usually locked, right? So, I mean, if I were queen of UCLP, I would think about more spaces that we could talk in. I mean, we don't have really, we don't have lounges. We kind of have one. We don't. I admit, I don't even use the garden. We have a lovely garden we don't use. And my husband keeps saying, "Why don't you use that garden?" Because he's an outdoors guy, and I said, "Well, I have to walk through a cafeteria to get to it." And I don't know why I don't go out to the garden, but something about it, I think, it makes it not the place we all meet. So that's partial answer. Anybody else? Anyone have one of those views of the garden? Oh, you do. So do you watch people?
I cannot.
Oh, you can't.
I don't
stare. But I did hear, I haven't actually been, that we got new planters.
Yeah.
Which I did suggest, so the world can change. I've been known to say, but as much as I complain about the building, you know, you can't say, there's no way you can make the case that what we do is not important. It's amazingly important. You know, when I go, Amy talked about, I have the privilege of getting to work with certain groups around the country. When I talk to them about our student body and how we conduct the world here, people are truly amazed. It's really nice. There was, there's some new film called The Ivory Tower that just came out. And, you know, she's always in this terrible, universities are more elitist than ever. They went to Harvard, Columbia, and Wesleyan. So, no wonder they found what they found. So it's really special. Lane?
Speaking of students, some of us began our careers with environment in this building was so hard not to have that interaction with students and with faculty. How do you deal with that?
So I really, that's the hardest part of my job is not having students or faculty here, and which really means having the campus. And I had no idea it would be that part would be so hard because I was already spending all my time in an administrative building, but it was in the middle of campus. So out my window, I could see the students, you know, every hour you'd see the students go by and, the faculty were all there. Maybe you and I have talked about this late, but when I get a chance to be on campus, I take it. Because I always learn, since I'm not from UC, I always learn something I didn't know, and it just feels so wonderful. I actually like sitting in student meetings still. Kind of anonymous a place of one here and then one there. Karen.
When you transitioned to being an administrator, did you figure out how to keep doing research in the
Not in the long run. So when I started, I was doing research for probably about the first 5 years, but it tapered off. So I mostly was completing things that were already in the works or doing book reviews, things that were kind of separable. And I have to say I started doing administration in the middle of what I think is and might be my best project on suffrage theater. So I have this amazing, I have file drawers at home full of lots of stuff I've collected from our archives in London that I've never gotten to work on. Although what I realized was I think I could have written a great book on the British suffrage theater, but that wasn't going to change the world the same way I can do it from here. That was hard to come to that recognition. No, I'm not really doing research now, although I kind of have moved into the research energy, and I do miss it because you just think differently. It's just like your brain has to be at 100% to really do research. which isn't always the case for administration. sorry. So I missed that, the stimulation of that. But I've kind of, the advanced project that Amy mentioned has really is very research-driven, so that's kind of where that part of my interest has gone. I also eventually had to give up teaching because, again, I couldn't, when I realized my best energy wasn't going to the students anymore, that just didn't seem right. So that was the last thing I gave up, was the teaching. So I miss that too. It's hard. It's so hard. So what's some
maybe, so I was going to ask about your partial appointment at UCA.
I think I would be welcomed. I just don't think I have the time. It would mean I don't know where I'd find the time. I truly don't. So when I talk to my colleagues here, you know, we speculate about wouldn't it be nice, and I don't see it in the cards until I'm not doing all the things I'm doing now.